After Party Pod is brought to you by the book Ending Addiction for Good, which is by Cliffside Treatment Center founder and CEO Richard Tate and Dr. Constance Scharf, Cliffside's addiction researcher. Through self-disclosure, case studies, scientific facts, and firsthand experience, Tate and Scharf explain how anyone can recover from addiction. I'm a big fan of the book. I'm not the only one. It's received rave reviews, and it also made it into the VMA's gift bag, and you just know those people need to hear this message. You can get the book by going to Amazon, or you can go to Cliffside's website, which is cliffsidemalibu.com. Get the book. Get it now. I recommend it. Hey guys, it's Anna David, host of After Party Pod. Which you know, because you just downloaded it. Yep. I am extremely honored and excited about today's guest. If you're listening to this podcast, I'm guessing you probably know about this guy. His name is Paul Gilmartin, and he has been a very successful comedian for many years. He hosted TBS's Dinner and a Movie for more than 16 years. That's a long time to have a job, let alone a job in television. And he has been on MTV, The Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson, Politically Incorrect. He's had a Comedy Central special. He's done that whole deal. But the reason we are talking to him today is that in 2001, he created a podcast called The Mental Illness Happy Hour. And it is one of the most riveting things I've ever listened to. It's definitely the most interesting podcast I know of. And as I told him in our interview, I don't believe this very podcast you're listening to right now would exist were it not for the Mental Illness Happy Hour. Because I don't think I realized that a podcast could talk about serious issues and also be entertaining sometimes and feature comedians and that kind of thing. This is an immensely popular podcast he hosts. It's had millions of downloads. It's had as guests people like Doug Benson and Paul F. Tompkins and Adam Carolla, and also previous After Party Pod guests like Greg Barrett and Jimmy Pardo. And that podcast is not afraid to go there. They do talk about addiction is a common topic. He also gets his guests talking about mental illness, depression, and abuse. And he has surveys that appear on mentalpod.com where people can anonymously fill out surveys where they can talk about shame, they can talk about happy moments. It's not all just the disturbing stuff. And he will always read the results of surveys, and it's fascinating the things that that have happened to the painful things that have happened to people and the way they've compartmentalized them. And I think oftentimes that's what I get the most out of when he reads the surveys is hearing about how people have what they've done with the disturbing things that have happened to them. And you know, Paul seems to very much be of the mindset that talking about these things heals us, which is what I very much believe. And Paul is also sober, by the way. Did I mention that already? So anyway, in our conversation, first of all, he completely hooked me up with his sound system. So you are listening to this on my, you know, shitty sound system, and you're about to your ears are in for just like the most amazing treat because it's going to sound so good because we use his sound system. So he not only did that, but he also really opened up, and we had, I'm just going to say it, more interesting conversation than I've had with any of the guests so far. And he kind of did a little table turning on me. He's good at that. So that I talked about, you know, my relationship with my non-relationship with my dad and my own experiences. So I hope you guys will like this one. I'm pretty positive you guys will like this one. Please let me know. You can support the show by giving positive reviews on iTunes or commenting or, I mean, you don't have to do that. Even people who just email me or tell me in person, I've gotten some texts too. People who like the show, and it means so much to hear that. And what else do I want to tell you? I mean, that theme song. You know that theme song. You know it's written by Seth Rothschild and performed by the Patience. We love it. Thank you guys for listening to this, and please enjoy Paul Gilmartin.
We're rolling.
Here we are. So now that you have completely set me up for this program, I almost want you to interview yourself. That's how much you've just done everything for me. This is so, I mean, if only everybody could invite me into their home, offer me a beverage, have dogs come over and kiss me, and then set up my entire podcasting system.
I take a lot of pride in having good audio quality. And when I see people struggling
right
to get good audio quality, because it's really so simple once you know the basics of it.
The word simple, it really does depend on how you define the word simple.
Because 6 months from now, I'll be the one teaching
people this.
Yes.
Basically, the last 5 minutes, for anyone who is not here, which is to say everyone who is listening, it was like, you just put this in, then you plug this into that, and then it's just so easy. You go like that. I mean, I have no idea what just happened, but I know it sounds damn good in these the earphones.
Good. Oh, good. Yes.
So it's such a pleasure to sit here with you. As I told you, I'm a huge fan of the podcast.
Oh, thanks.
And think, you know, it's a huge inspiration to what I'm doing with the website that I started, but particularly with this podcast. I don't know that this would exist if yours didn't, because I didn't think it was possible to sort of address these issues from a non-clinical point of view and sometimes actually be lighthearted. And
sometimes be what?
Lighthearted.
Oh, yes.
That's that thing when people smile. Yeah.
I did. For some reason, I just heard hearted and I was like, oh, is that a...
That's a thing. Yes. It's a term.
Yeah.
That I just coined. But also to make it, for lack of a better word, I guess, entertaining.
Thank you. I mean, those are like the things that I set out to accomplish with it. So it's incredibly satisfying to hear somebody confirm that
I'm certainly
accomplishing.
Not the first. I know that. And yes, I found you because I did a story on Marc Maron a few years ago, and somebody emailed me and said, if you like Marc Maron, you're going to love Paul Gilmartin. I started listening to the podcast, and I had this idea in my head that you would, that you kind of didn't do press, that you were sort of ungettable. Yes.
What?
I don't know. I am an alcoholic, which is to say, in this particular case, that I take a little bit of information, I write a massive story, I believe it wholeheartedly, oftentimes getting depressed in the process. I didn't go through a major depression. I was just like, oh, okay. So, you know, I can sort of listen to this guy and get to know him from afar. I just somehow, it was in my head that this would not be possible. Dreams do come true in Hollywood. So I guess what happened is I started doing this podcast and I realized that I was interviewing people that I had really enjoyed hearing on your podcast, people like Greg Barrett and Jimmy Pardo. And Allison Rosen is an old friend of mine.
Oh, I love Allison.
Yeah. And so I just said, what the hell? I'm going to reach out and look where we sit. And you were very kind and responded positively.
Well, I'm kind of flattered and surprised anytime anybody wants to interview me and recognizes what I'm doing. I think because I've felt invisible so much of my life, not around friends, but just in terms of like to strangers. I don't know how to describe it. There's an awesome article by Dr. Alan Rappaport that I just did a little mini episode on, where I actually just read this article he wrote about co-narcissism when you grow up with a narcissistic parent. And one of the things is you have no sense of what you're feeling, what your opinions are. You just live through other people's opinion of you. Mm. So you don't really have a sense of self because your childhood was spent feeding your parents' needs. And they loved you as long as you were behaving how they wanted you to behave, because they viewed you as an extension of themselves, not as a separate person with their own thoughts and needs and desires, etc. And it was mind-blowing to me when I read it, because it explained so much about me and about my mom, and it actually allowed me to have more compassion for both of us. Mm. But it struck home that, reconfirmed that sickness that I have in me, which is a struggling to find a sense of self. It gets better as time goes on. Certainly has gotten much better since I got sober, but it's something I still struggle with. I'm convinced that everybody, and this is one of the things he says in his article, is you're convinced that everybody else is narcissistic the way your parent is. So I assume that everybody is waiting to pounce on a mistake that I make.
Okay, you said 16 things that I want to respond to. One is fascinating about co-narcissism. I've never heard that term before. And especially if you couple it with alcoholism, because I sort of think of, you know, you get sober and literally people would say to me, you know, what's your favorite color? And I would have absolutely no way of answering that question, let alone everything else about my life. And so much of that had to do with the fact that I was drowning out my system and that I didn't really have an identity beyond this girl who partied. But so much of it had to do with the fact that there was no room in my family for your opinions, your anything. And I just think that so the combination means that you're going to get sober and have no fucking idea who you are or what you like.
Right. And the other thing that the article said, which was a little hard to accept, but I know it's the truth, is there's the co-narcissist is often also a narcissist. And I know that's true about me, because some of the things they were describing about the narcissist was like, oh, that's uncomfortable to read, but I definitely have those qualities. And the other thing that they said was that the narcissist is generally a little less narcissistic than their parent. So it does get better over time, especially if that co-narcissist seeks help.
Okay, interesting. Again, 16 jumping off points from what you said, and my brain has only the ability to probably remember one. But okay, so what has always come up in therapy whenever I've sort of explored the I'm a narcissist territory, what has come back to me is, well, actually, narcissists don't worry about being narcissistic. It's right. One of the elements of narcissism. Trust me, my dad has never gone into his therapist and tried to analyze whether or not he's narcissistic. But the other thing, oh, and here's where my feeble brain gets put to its test, were you accused of being narcissistic by your parents?
Oh, yeah. And not by my dad. My dad just wasn't, he was trapped in his own head at the end of the couch.
Right.
My mom would project stuff onto me. She would call me selfish. She would call me a martyr. All the things that she was, you know, which isn't to say that I wasn't ever that way,
right. But
it was, I believed her.
Right.
I really grew up believing that I was a selfish person who had to do certain things to be lovable.
And what about your family and your podcast?
They don't listen to it that I'm aware of. I've asked my mom, I haven't talked to her in a year and a half, but, when I first started doing it, I told her about it, but I said, I'd rather you don't listen to it. At this point, if she sought it out on her own and listened to it, I would be okay with it, because I'm kind of done apologizing for her possibly being embarrassed.
Mm.
I know I've probably thrown her under the bus by making some backhanded jokes a couple of times in the podcast. But I kind of feel like parents need to earn their children's respect.
Mm.
That it's, I don't buy that you've got to respect them just because you came out of them, you know. So.
I relate.
Yeah.
Did not respecting your parents give you issues with authority figures?
Yes and no, because I did respect my parents.
Because you didn't know there was a choice.
I didn't know there was a choice, and it's not that I was afraid of disrespecting them. They didn't instill any type of fear. They weren't violent. They weren't physically punishing. They didn't really raise their voices. But it was the path of least resistance
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
to just go along with things. And you grow up when you're feeding that parent's needs. You grow up not knowing what you're feeling. And especially when kind of creepy stuff has been done to you, you learn to blame yourself and then not trust your body and then not live in your body, especially when you have a parent that talks constantly but doesn't really say anything. You learn to tune out. So all of those things, you kind of become dissociated from mm-hmm. your body and your feelings. So you don't really know what it is that you're feeling. So you become addicted to fantasy.
But were you angry at them?
I wasn't at them until I got into therapy. And then I was just outraged.
And the decision not to speak to your mom, how did that happen?
I had a breakdown about a year and a half ago. I was getting ready to go home to Chicago, where she lives, to help her move from her condo to a retirement home, and to celebrate her 84th birthday, I think it was, or 83rd birthday. And it had been accumulating over a period of time. One of my support groups helps people who are struggling with intimacy mm-hmm. and respecting their own feelings, being in their body. And many of us are survivors of various types of abandonment or abuse, mm-hmm. particularly sexual abuse. I didn't think I had been sexually abused, and I still struggle to use that word because it feels a little overly dramatic. But one of the things I learned in that support group was to begin to listen to my body and to not assume that whatever I'm feeling or thinking is wrong. Mm-hmm. And it started one Christmas. My mom sends me these packages around Christmas time of shit that I'm not interested in, things I've asked her not to send me, stuff she bought for other people. It just feels like stuff you would put on the curb.
Wrapped?
Some wrapped, some okay. not. And I would always dread opening it because it was just a reminder that I don't feel seen or heard. And I decided to not just assume I'm a bad son and say, why does this give me a knot in my stomach? And I realized I don't feel seen. This right. thing is just like a big, you are who I want you to be. I want to change you. And that was the beginning of me opening the door to the possibility that her idea of what love is, I don't experience as love.
Right.
Because I know she's trying to love me right. as best she can. But I needed to finally respect what it was that I was feeling. And it was dread and 1,000 other negative feelings.
Right.
And I began to, as I talked to her on the phone, she would infantilize me. She would talk about me as if I was an object. Mom's cutest, mom's this. It was always this kind of possessive right. thing. You know, one of the things that I first learned in therapy in my mid-20s was that it was inappropriate for her to be pinching my ass and telling me how cute I was. Mm-hmm. I'd always let her do it because right. it was her need, and I wanted to make her happy because she was a deeply unhappy person who would confide in me how miserable she was in her marriage, how she wanted to leave all of us, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And so the therapist said, how does it make you feel? Do you like it? And I said, no. And she said, well, then why do you let her do it? And I said, because it makes her happy. And she's like, but what about your feelings? And I had never thought about how it made me feel. And she said, would it be appropriate for a man to be doing that to his daughter? And I said, no. She said, well, then why is it appropriate right. for that? And this fucking rage came up in me. And that was the first time I realized that I was kind of being sexualized and objectified. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I thought I was done with it. My wife had always told me, I don't think you've really processed this. And I would just think, you don't really like my mom.
Right.
That's you just wanting to feed that hatred that you have about my mom. So I began to listen to how she talked to me on the phone, and I began to realize if my child had told me 24 years ago, please don't grab my ass, please don't talk to me like I'm your date, I would make sure, if I was really listening to my child, I would make sure I didn't. So then we just start, we got cut off there. If my child had told me 24 years ago that, please don't do these things.
You would not need to be told again.
I would not need to be told again. And that was like hugely painful because, so I coupled that with the Christmas box, the feeling objectified, and the memories that I'd never really given weight to, creepy things that she had done. She didn't touch my genitals, but there was a sexual charge in the air. There was an inappropriateness to it. I was naked for many of them. I suddenly went, oh my God. I don't know how to describe it, but it was the most pain I've ever felt in my life. And I went to my wife and I said, I need a hug. I'd always had this fantasy when I was a kid that I could go to an older girl on the playground and she would wrap me in her arms and I'd be able to cry. Mm-hmm. And when I got into therapy, I was like, oh, clearly I wasn't mothered.
Right.
That's what it was about. But I didn't know what it was that I wanted to say to that older girl. When I went to hug my wife, the words came out of my mouth and I realized it had been what I'd wanted to say all my life. And I said to my wife, she tricked me. She used me. And I was a good kid and I didn't deserve it. And I just started sobbing. Mm-hmm. And my wife said, I've been waiting 20 years for you to say that. And it felt so good to have my feelings validated. And it was so painful, but it was so life-changing because I finally saw whether or not it's the truth, it's my truth.
Right.
It's what I was feeling. It's what I'd been burying because I had told myself, because when one of the creepy things happened, I became aroused. Right. And I had always told myself that I was dirty.
Right.
That
I was. Felt a lot of shame.
A lot of shame.
Yeah.
And I thought I was just weird and perverted. Mm. And I was finally able to put the responsibility where it belonged. And I couldn't, the thought of being in the same room with her was horrifying. And so I called and left her a message when I knew she wasn't going to be home. I apologize for my dogs. Do you want me to put them in the back bedroom?
I don't mind it. They've started to make different noises now.
Yeah, he's trying to hump her. He does that when he's trying to show how powerful he is.
It's inappropriate pairing. It's probably appropriate for the conversation.
Yeah.
So did you tell your mom why?
I didn't. I did in a general way because one of the things about her that I know is that she doesn't usually own up to her side of things unless it fits into a narrow window of what she can accept.
Right.
And I also knew there's a possibility that she wasn't even really conscious of what it was that she was doing.
Right.
So I just left a message and said, I don't hate you. I'm not mad at you. I'm just exhausted by our relationship and I need a break. And she called back and left a message and said, I understand.
That's amazing. Yeah. I find that part amazing.
Yeah. And, you know, she has been in a support group for 30 years. Never done the work.
Right.
But I think she can occasionally detach. And so I decided to start up a correspondence by mail because I thought I can handle that. But even, you know, like her second and third letter started to get manipulative and just made me really sad. And I thought, I got to protect myself.
Right.
I'm going to put them in the back
bedroom. Yeah, I guess it got a little much, guys.
Come on. Let's go.
That's fine.
Okay.
Hi, we're back. The inappropriate dogs have been quarantined.
So I have stopped writing letters. In fact, I just got one 5 minutes before you came. And,
nice.
And I wasn't going to open it. And I thought, well, maybe it'll be something to talk about on the
stir
podcast.
Up some stuff.
But there wasn't any kind of, there was just, I think about you every day.
Right.
And there wasn't any guilting in it. But I'm trying to respect what I'm feeling, which is that I don't want to have contact with her. I haven't written her off.
Right.
For the rest of my life, I, you know, I'm not going to think about that. I'm just going to kind of take it as it goes and just respect what it is that I'm feeling, because I've learned in one of my support groups that one of the reasons why I engage in addictive behavior sometimes is because I want to escape what it is that
right.
I'm feeling, because I'm not trusting what I'm feeling in my body.
Right. Right. Do you, if she said to you, I have been thinking, she wrote, I've been thinking about it, and I now realize what I've done, and it, what kind of a difference would that make?
I would look around to make sure that I wasn't in hell, and it wasn't sub-zero.
It's not likely.
Not likely. If she did, I would be so thrilled, and I would call her.
Right.
Immediately. And I would say thank you for that. I would like to try to have a relationship with boundaries.
Right.
I might at some point even do that, whether or not
right.
she does that, because I know that she's sick. She had a right. terribly abandoning childhood. But one of the things that I've realized is I can have compassion for others, but not at the expense of compassion for myself.
Right. Right.
And at this point, that's what I would be doing.
Right. Which is what you had to do your entire childhood without being conscious.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, so I just told you while the mics were off that I have a very similar story. And broadly, it's just that my dad has always been inappropriate to me from a very young age. He never touched me, but everything he said, his obsession with taking my picture, the ways he compared me to my mother, it was a constant... onslaught of this, and in front of everybody saw it. And I first realized it when I was in college, and for many years I continued to have a relationship with him. I'm a super confrontational person, so I immediately called them up after therapy, both of them, and I said, this happened and you guys saw, and they did not respond well without going into many details. And And I just continue to
I would like to know the details of how they responded.
Oh, you know, I mean, the thing is, my mom and I are incredibly close, and I love her very much. With my dad, quite frankly, I not only don't love him, I don't like him, you know, and this has actually very little to do, as far as I know, with all of the inappropriate stuff. But
usually that's just an extension of who they are. As a person.
I shouldn't throw him entirely under the bus. He's not a very appealing guy on any
Throw him under
level.
A scooter.
but so I would say he doesn't hear anything. You know, I mean, I would have conversations with him and I would set certain boundaries and he would nod, and then he would 5 minutes later not, you know, respect that boundary and pretend we'd never talked about it. So, I mean, that was sort of to be expected. You know, my mom, I think, really struggled with how to handle it. And my dad went
to... They still together?
This is so insane. They got divorced. They should never have been married. They got divorced. My mom was very happily married for 18 years to the most wonderful, amazing guy who was much older than she was. And he died a few years ago. And... and I don't want to disrespect her and go into too much, but they are very close. They are not together, but they are very close. And my dad went to the National False Memory Foundation or something, this place where parents who are accused of abuse go. And that doesn't make a lot of sense given that we all saw this, we all admit, so there's nothing false going on. And I guess he would go and he would find other people and they would sit there and talk about like how their kids made stuff up. And at a certain point I realized that there was no way for me to have a relationship with my dad that was not re-traumatizing. I tried. I mean, I really was like, the dude could die and I could feel terrible and this will be unresolved. And I have tried and I really have tried as much as a human being can try. And there does not seem to be a way for me to interact with him in a way. Because now I write about this. I've written about it in a few books. And so my parents don't read it, don't really follow anything I do. And my dad apparently decided to read one of these very short books. He could handle that. And so the last time I saw him, he decided to confront me about what I'd written, which is very complicated considering the fact that he won't admit that it's true. And there was something about the insanity of being confronted about something I'd written, which about him, which he will not admit is true, that I was like, I cannot be around this guy. It is not okay. I am really sacrificing myself for him. And he sort of, I think he accepts that. I don't think who knows what he cares about. He doesn't pursue it. And so yeah, it's pretty sad.
What would he say to you when he would be taking these pictures and things of you?
Oh, his whole thing with me is just, you're the most beautiful woman in the world. You're so much more beautiful than your mother. I mean, from the time
That's
I was
so
like
gross.
5, 6, 7. Yeah.
And by the way, my mom showered way more physical affection on me. I never saw her be physically affectionate to my father. Also never saw him be physically affectionate to her.
Right.
And so you grow up with this weird sense of icky, but also kind of powerful.
Well, definitely. And I definitely used that to my advantage and my detriment many, many times. I mean, my first few jobs, I always would be the boss's favorite. And we would have this like slightly inappropriate relationship where I kind of completely manipulated him and thought I could get away with murder, even though he was the one in charge. And it worked. And it worked and worked and worked until it started to backfire and get me fired. And I realized I couldn't. I almost can't work for men. I mean, I almost can't work for anybody, let's be honest. I work much better for myself. But yeah, it is something that is there that you know, not a lot of people are comfortable talking about. And yet I think
with you or about themselves.
In general, you know, I mean, about whether or not that kind of thing happened in their own family. I mean, I do think that dysfunctional families, oftentimes the mother will make the son into the surrogate husband and the father will make the daughter into the surrogate girlfriend or whatever it is, because the parents aren't having a relationship. And I'm not saying everybody needs to go and examine whether or not that took place, but I think it's more common than is discussed.
I think it's one of the most common things in the world.
Yeah.
So many of the people in my support group, that's exactly what happened to them.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that some people like it, you know, and it doesn't go into creep. And I actually do think there's a huge difference. I mean, this may sound really overly simplistic, but like, sorry, I'm having a headphone drop. you know, I think if you are very fond of your parent, your opposite gender parent, and they do that, you have a much different relationship with it, you know? Where you're, you know, daddy's little girl and you love, you know, I just always is like, my dad is such an unappealing dude. I didn't want his attention. And the whole sort of Freudian notion and the Oedipal complex and the Electra complex, when the parent is superseding what should be happening so that the little girl who's supposed to be fantasizing about killing her mother so she can marry her father, when the father's already like acting like she's the wife, you know, you can't actually have that. I believe in those developmental stages.
How has it affected your sexuality and your chance to be truly intimate, emotionally intimate with a partner?
A, this is my podcast, not yours.
I'll share about mine.
We really just to keep it. I mean, it's okay. We're happy to talk, but let's do you first, at least.
It has made it for many years. I could only be attracted to somebody who wasn't crazy about me.
Mm.
If they were crazy about me, it freaked me out.
Yeah.
Probably one of the reasons I picked my wife is she's kind of an emotionally, not very expressive person. She expresses it through cooking for me, thinking about my practical needs, being intimate occasionally, but the furthest thing from smothering or right. or needy. And we connected on kind of an emotional level. We both love dogs. Mm-hmm. And that was a safe way for me to experience that. But now I'm finding myself wanting more intimacy. And we're struggling with that because there are things that you kind of don't address when, you know, I'm speaking for myself, when you don't crave intimacy and then suddenly you want intimacy. But it affected my sex became about control for me. And, you know, in my early years about conquest and yeah, that's kind of, one of the things that reminds me that it's not my fault for my sexuality being the way it is, and having difficulty connecting my heart to my genitals
right.
is when the memories, when I gave weight to the memories about things that my mom did that felt creepy and sexual to me, particularly the one where I became aroused. I'd never had this fantasy before, but after I gave weight to it, suddenly I had fantasies about not my mom, but a woman who had all the qualities that I wanted my mom to have. I fantasized about myself going back to that age, being mm-hmm. 11 again, and getting an inappropriate bath from an older woman, an older girl, or a mom doing that to me, but it going all the way in terms of like her bringing me to an orgasm, but not in a way where she is outwardly sexually turned on. She is still doing it as if she's
being maternal, sort of?
Being maternal, sort of. And then the fantasy after the young me would have a dry orgasm is that then she would wrap me in a towel and I would cry and she would comfort me. And I'd never had that fantasy before. And suddenly this became the most powerful fantasy in the world to me. And it reconfirmed in me that our sexuality is so often imprinted by trauma that has happened to us. And it was reconfirmed by the thousands of surveys I've read that people fill out on the website where they share their deepest shame and secrets. And so many of them, their sexual fantasies are so obviously tied to the trauma that happened,
right.
where they're trying to go back and relive what happened to them, but have some sense of control in it. And that was greatly relieving to me because I was able to let go of the shame that I felt about what happened to me and becoming aroused in that one instance. By the way, my first instinct when she wanted to give me that inappropriate bath was, ooh.
Right, interesting.
I want to put
it's like your body betrayed you.
It did. And so I've lived the first 48 years of my life not trusting my body and thinking my body is betraying me because I'm inherently dirty.
Right. I was going to say about your surveys, when you read them, what's so interesting, when you read them aloud, I mean, it seems that there is so much of whatever that option is, something happened, but I'm not sure if it was sexual abuse.
Yeah.
And because you're reading the whole thing right there, it's so easy to connect the dots, you know, and as the listener, you connect the dots in a way that the person who wrote it did not. And it's a fascinating exercise.
It's so much easier to have empathy for other people's trauma than it is your own. And my therapist said, it's because you avoided as a child that frightening truth, which is you are in the hands of somebody who is exploiting or predatory towards your body. Right. And I remember brushing those thoughts out of my mind. I'm feeling kind of shame right now because I feel like I'm a broken record when I do podcasts, but this is my story and this right. is the stuff that's really important to me. She took my temperature rectally until I was 8 years old. And I remember thinking to myself, this doesn't feel right. I remember asking right. her, why can't I put it in right. in my mouth? Why? And she said, well, I'm afraid you're going to bite down on it and break the thermometer. And I just remember, and her whole demeanor would change when she would do it. And then she would disappear with the thermometer for a long time afterwards. And I just remember thinking, is she getting something out of this? And then brushing that thought away
right.
because I would say moms wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that I gave weight to when I put all the pieces together. In my support right. group, one of the things you learn to do to learn about yourself is to look at your patterns of behavior instead of the isolated incidents.
Right.
And that's how I made the breakthrough, was I looked at her patterns
right.
and I put them all together, because each individual one you could explain away.
Right, right, right.
And that's, I think, how people who have a slightly predatory nature or a fully predatory nature is that they become master manipulators at disguising what it is that they're doing.
Right, right.
Either to themselves or consciously towards that person they're abusing.
What do you think about the chances of them repeating things that had happened to them?
100%.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody does it.
They just get the idea.
Yeah. Although I've learned, there's this great article about the different types of predators, and there are situational, I may be botching the word, situational predators and preferential predators. And a preferential predator, that's the thing that turns them on, that they seek out to the exclusion of other things. A situational predator may be somebody who prefers adults, but in that given situation.
Right, like a jail.
Yes.
That's like
a jail.
Jail gay guy.
Yeah. So that's...
Question off the beaten path. Do you have chronic pain issues?
I did. I used to.
You know, there's a great connection between...
holding those emotions in. And...
Yeah. Sexual trauma in particular in chronic pain, which is not very widely publicized. I didn't know it, and I was surprised when I heard it.
My best friend is a interventional pain specialist, and he says he sees so many clients, patients, mostly women, who have this unspecified pain, and he tries sometimes to go to the place of asking about their childhood or suggesting that they get into therapy, that there might be
right.
some type of trauma in their past. And he says most of them just shut it down like a bank vault because it's too scary to go to that place.
That's so, I mean, I come from a community, Jew from Marin County, like therapy was like, that's what you just did. My nephew's been in therapy for years and he's turning 5, literally.
Really?
Not even kidding. Yeah. I went at 16 and I've been in it pretty much steadily ever since. But you did not go. So basically your path in terms of awareness, sobriety predated therapy or the other way around?
A portion of therapy, a year and a half of therapy predated, actually probably a total of about 3 years predated sobriety.
Did you have one of those therapists who said, I can't continue to see you unless you clean up your act?
Yeah.
I always hear about those.
He was a psychiatrist actually.
Uh-huh.
And I did finally say, I think I need to stop self-medicating or I'm going to die.
He didn't say it to you.
But he said, I can't take your money.
Was it just alcohol?
It was alcohol and weed.
Uh-huh.
Those were the major.
And you weren't things. Lying to him about it? You were telling him the truth about what you were doing?
Yeah, but I was under-exaggerating, understating right. how much I was doing. But the fact that I couldn't quit, that my brain would think up a reason why tonight was going to be the last night I was going to get loaded, and tomorrow.
Right.
I believed it.
Right.
I really believed it. But after 6 months of becoming more and more sad and seeing it progress and becoming more and more suicidal, I knew enough. I could understand intellectually that this is not going to a good place.
And was there addiction in your family?
Oh, yeah.
Everybody?
the males, most of the males, mm-hmm. In my bloodline are alcoholic.
And no sobriety.
Very little. Mm-hmm. Very little. A few.
And what was your stance on sobriety? Was that something that you knew about before you did it? Like you thought it was weird?
My dad had gotten sober and I saw a change in him. You know, he didn't really put the work in. He was kind of half-assed about it. But the times when he was into it and getting help and giving help, I could see a joy in him that I'd never seen before.
How old were you?
I was in my 20s. Mm-hmm. It was 90. In fact, I remember 92 Christmas, December of 92. He tried to kill himself. He didn't show up for a meeting in New York and had tried to open his veins in a bathtub and had been committed to Bellevue. Uh-huh. You know, when you think of like the stereotype of the nut house, that's probably a derogatory term for it, psychiatric hospital.
But it is the one. I lived in New York. I felt like I knew plenty of people who went to Bellevue when I was living in New York.
The psychiatrist wouldn't release him unless he went directly to rehab from the airport. And so we picked him up on Christmas Eve of 1992 and took him to rehab. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the first inklings that my gut feeling about my parents being kind of sad, broken people was not me making it up in my mind.
Right.
But we had a couple of groups, mm-hmm. group meetings, where I could feel things starting to thaw mm-hmm. in him. And that kind of helped me know that, yeah, maybe this thing works.
And so you got sober, and was there a period of time where you thought, okay, I found it. I've solved the problem. This is it. And then you realized otherwise?
I mean, I enjoyed support groups for sobriety right out of the gate. Right. It felt like home. And I had heard enough people say, we're never done. It's layers of an onion. And so I've always kind of been seeking that next layer. But I do have periods where I think, I got it going on.
Right.
I got it. I'm good.
Right.
I'm just going to help others.
Right.
And then a layer comes up and I'm on the phone going, help me. Right. I'm so lost. I'm so angry. I'm so confused. I can't get out of bed.
Right. I'm going to refer to my paperwork because I think this is actually from your site, the way that, it's a quote you gave. My wife very gently suggested I go see somebody. I came to find out that I had a drug and alcohol problem. I knew I was a heavy user, but I didn't know that I had lost the ability to quit. This is not the quote I meant to be reading. But it was basically like you realized, like you were like, wait, I'm still an asshole, even though I'm sober. Mm-hmm. What's the problem now? And then you realized depression and mental illness was a separate issue.
Yeah. I realized there's a part of me that is self-centered and afraid that doesn't really want to reach out. And I will probably be fighting that for the rest of my life. But like anything you practice, it gets easier the more you do it, the more you pick up the phone when you don't want to talk,
right.
when you don't want to go into that icky, gray, confusing ball in your stomach. So it does... It'll probably never go away, but I'm resigned to the fact that it's work I have to do if I want to have a quality of life and not go back to that place of thinking about suicide 50 times a day.
And so the process of getting on medication, one thing I would love to hear your opinion on, you know, there are people who will say one is you're not sober if you take medication.
I want to punch them.
Very much misunderstanding the difference between medication that is addictive, that where you build up a tolerance and you need to take more in order to feel the same effect, and medication that is to treat a pre-existing condition. Go. Let your rage out.
You just summed it up, but I want to punch him in the fucking face and saying your opinion may
kill
lead
people.
To somebody's suicide.
Oh, it absolutely has killed people without a doubt, that point of view.
And they usually say it in such an arrogant way, but that's an alcoholic who's in their sickness.
Right.
A narcissist who's in their sickness is they think their opinion is the only one that matters. And I feel like that type of attitude should be reserved for those who have lived that experience, not those who are judging it from the outside.
Yes, and I think they are people who are confusing sobriety with a medical degree.
Yes.
Perhaps.
And they don't understand that it's just like diabetes.
Right.
You have chemicals that you can't produce.
Right.
It's not, doesn't bring you, my meds don't make me euphoric.
Right.
They give me a chance to be normal.
Right, right. That, it does, there doesn't seem to be anything that, I mean, whatever, I think we are slowly making progress in terms of educating people about that, but it is a misconception that, I can't even tell you how, the places that I see it, there was an article in, not the Atlantic. God, it possibly was the Atlantic. And it was this very widely circulated piece about this guy in sobriety talking about taking meds and not understanding that there was a difference between, say, Klonopin and Prozac. And I think it's so dangerous and so sad that people think that they can talk about it.
Yeah, you know, there is a huge difference between Effexor and benzos.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's very frustrating. There was another article that fucking pissed me off so much. And these research scientists at UCLA had determined that there's no such thing as sex and love addiction.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's... That definitely is a controversy that you know, I think Salon even published a piece about it. Salon, the most, I respect that website so much. I think we are in the nascent stages of awareness about a lot of these things. And I think also with the medications, you know, we are the experimental generation. They're, you know, our kids are, you know, or however long they're going to be able to do a blood test and go, okay, you're depressed. We're going to give you this one. We know it'll work. They don't know shit right now. They're finding out just by seeing how it impacts the people taking those things now.
Yeah. It's the dark ages, but
it really is
lighter than it was 40 years ago.
Absolutely.
I mean, I feel so much pity and sympathy for people, you know, at the turn of the 1900s where there wasn't even support groups yet for addiction, let alone meds.
I know. And we are lucky to be in Los Angeles, to be in a place where finding sobriety is not, you are not hardly ostracized or shamed for it.
It's almost a badge of courage. Like, oh, I'm damaged. I'm an artist.
Yeah. Well, and it's also more common than not, you know? And I think that, in what you do with the podcast in terms of spreading awareness about this is so important because there are so many misconceptions out there about depression and about addiction.
That's one of the things that led me to start the podcast was I went off my meds in late 2010, early 2011, and saw my depression creeped back, but because it took 5 months for it to creep back in, I thought it was reality.
Right.
And I wanted to kill myself because I thought my life really is over. And one day I went, oh my God, it's my depression. And I thought somebody needs to talk about how mental illness camouflages itself. But in a way that isn't like Dr. Phil or people in Sedona talking about Mother
crystals,
Earth,
yeah,
and crystals and that precious sacred space and, you know, that those buzzwords, even though I think those people are well-intentioned, the language and the whole vibe about it, I just could never get into it because it just felt very kind of, I don't know, it just bugged me.
Yeah, it's, I agree. I mean, I think it's good. It's good to start the conversation, but it is hard to find the conversation done in an approachable way, which is what the gift, I think, even saying the gift that you give sounds like one of those Sedona people, but it's true.
And I learned that in support groups. I didn't come up with that on my own. And by the way, Mark Maron's podcast was, I think, to what my podcast is to you, his podcast was to me, in that he unapologetically talked about dark subjects.
Right.
And I thought that that would, maybe it was the comedian in me that thought, oh no, you know, that's going to be a turnoff. It's going to be too much of a bummer. But, you know, one of the things that is comforting to me sometimes is watching a documentary about a serial killer.
Right.
And I realize that for people who live in darkness, other darkness can become light.
Absolutely.
As long as it's done in a way that isn't gratuitous or exploitive.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's the theory behind the support groups. And that's that feeling of, oh my God, I'm not, you know, suffering with this secret all alone. You know, I for years, had a job giving sex and dating advice on a television show, and I was giving people program. And what I, realized was, that the thing people kept writing me about was, I feel like a freak and I think I'm the only one. That was the same question I got over and over again. It just was disguised as different words. Okay. And that it was everything I had learned through getting sober and through finding healthy ways to live that gave me the ability to give sex and dating advice. Who knew?
So much of it springs from what we learn in support groups, because we're forced to go deep to find out that sick prism we filter reality through, our fear, our resentment, our past experience, our arrogance.
Right.
You know, all those things. But once you get that information, it's like a map where you can now avoid the parts of the forest that are dead ends.
Right. Or you hopefully... In an ideal world, you can avoid those parts. Oftentimes, I need to go to those parts and then be like reminded.
Yeah,
to avoid them.
Yeah, because I think we have to live. We're so stubborn sometimes. We have to try ways that don't work to prove to ourselves, like
right.
a scientific experiment. We
right.
have to try every other way.
Well, and I think also the human will is such that you can. Mine anyway. I will not change until I'm in so much pain, and pain only comes from trying to do it the bad way over and over and over again. And then at one point the pain gets too much and I go, okay, willing to find another way.
And a little pissed off about
yeah.
it.
Usually just sad. I go to sad.
Yeah.
But okay, let's just
sad and pissed are neighbors.
They really are. I mean, I was angry for the first 25 years of my life. I never got sad, just mad, real mad. And then I learned that sad was on the other side, and I'm like, I kind of miss mad. You know, at least I felt powerful.
Yeah.
I still get mad, trust me. But okay, I would love to just walk through the broad strokes of the podcast. So you started it when?
March of 2011.
And it immediately caught on. I know that it's a million downloads now. A year? Million downloads a year?
It's actually now it's to a couple. I think we're around 5 or 6 million total.
That's amazing.
In the 2.5 years that we've done. It's about a quarter of a million a month. So whatever that is, between 200,000 and 250,000 a month. That's because people download the back episodes.
Okay. Yeah. They find it and then they go back and listen to all of them.
Yeah.
And
or some of them.
It got, you know, and the Onion AV Club listed it as one of the 10 best podcasts in
2011. Yeah.
Okay. So, and so how did people find it? How did it catch on?
I went on other people's podcasts. My friend Jimmy Pardo, having me on his, was a big, big reason for it kind of catching on immediately, because he has a lot of listeners.
Mm-hmm.
Being on Marin, being on The Nerdist, those things, The Onion covering it from like mm-hmm. the 8th week on, Nathan Rabin, who used to be head writer there. Was a huge champion of the podcast, and really, for me, was that first validation in the media that I respect, that
right.
I immediately felt like I've arrived in
right.
terms of public. because I can find any reason to shit on somebody liking something about me. They don't know, right. Or but I feel like the people that write for The Onion, they're pretty smart. Yeah. There's a cynicism there.
Yeah.
And for something as sincere as my podcast, yeah, to be embraced by them, I feel like it must be pretty genuine for it to pass muster. Yeah. With them.
And in the New York Times, I mean, it was hardly shoddy other coverage. I mean,
yeah, the Atlantic did a really nice article about that. Kyle Dowling, I'm so thankful to him for doing that interview. And getting, honestly, getting feedback from peers of mine that I respect, that was huge. Paul F. Tompkins, I remember him sending an email and just being like, oh my God. Paul F. Tompkins likes something that I'm doing. Jen Kirkman, Jimmy Pardo. Even though I know Jimmy likes me and loves me, I didn't think something like that would maybe be his cup of tea. I don't think he's a listener, but knowing that he respects something like that, and I don't know, I've just gotten such genuinely nice things from people that it. And the feedback I get from listeners, that is, I suppose, how they feel about my podcast. That feeling that they get, I get that in return when I get a nice email from them, or I meet them in person and we hug, and maybe we get a little teary, and then we, you know, let each other know what's going on with us, and. I love, like, meeting a listener for coffee. And...
Well, that happens.
Oh, yeah.
So they email you and they say, I'm in town, or I live here, and I would love to meet. And you always go and meet them?
I don't always, but I can if my schedule permits, right, and I get the feeling like it might be an okay experience.
Right, right.
I've yet to have a bad experience with meeting somebody. And oftentimes the broad strokes they'll share with me about their story, I'll say, hey, let's record something. I can't promise it'll air.
Right.
I warn all my guests, I can't promise their episode will ever air. But if I have a hunch, I'll go ahead and record, because I'd rather take that chance than to try to predict how it's going to go and never have that chance.
And so have you not aired episodes with,
yes,
with even guests that you've specifically pursued?
Yes, there's been many that I haven't aired. Some I won't rule out that they'll air, but I try to air whatever is needed for the podcast that week, be it a subject that hasn't been talked about or an episode that's just so good it needs to go to the front of the line. I felt that way about Cameron Esposito's episode. I recorded her only a couple of weeks ago, and I just couldn't wait for it to get out there because it was just such a great conversation, and she was so open and honest and funny, and I thought her story was important. And she had like a breakthrough in the middle of the interview where she got in touch with anger that had been buried about her childhood.
How many do you have in the bank?
I've probably got about 6 months worth of episodes in the bank.
That's insane. Yeah.
It is.
Okay.
But I'm insane. So understand that. I enjoy recording people. It's not work for me. So
right.
If somebody has a story that's interesting, or sounds interesting, I can't wait to go record them, because it's, you know, being in support groups, this is the food for our soul.
Right.
And I need to eat it.
And so when does one drop? Is it every
late Thursday night? For those who live east of here, it would be early Friday morning.
Uh-huh.
I suppose it's early Friday morning because it's usually after midnight for me.
Right.
So yeah, Fridays.
And you don't do live ones?
No, I did do a live. I recorded it with a live audience in Portland. It was Karen Kilgariff. Great episode.
Right,
and that was so. I've never felt so safe and vulnerable on stage. I was a little nervous because I'd never been my non-stand-up persona on stage, and it was just so nice to feel that. to have all those listeners in the room.
And you build it. They were fans of yours from comedy. They were fans of the podcast. How did
I think
you...
fans of the podcast. Right. Yeah. Cause it was a daytime, live recording at the Bridgetown Comedy Festival. And I'm so grateful for the people that organized that for taking the chance to have something that isn't quote unquote comedic.
Comedy, yeah.
Yeah. Even though Karen had a lot of,
funny
humor in
right.
it. It was, I'll remember it for the rest of my life because it was like, oh, I can do these. I can,
right.
I can take this on the road. I don't know if I, it's not financially viable right now. I would probably just be covering my expenses to go do it. I'm doing one in Toronto, November 15th and 16th. I'm going to do a group recording of listeners on Friday night and then a live, podcast recording with a single guest on Saturday afternoon. We haven't figured out the guest yet, but I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, and in terms of, and there's you take donations, and you showed me when I walked in here what donors can get. Some pretty badass cool wood stuff.
Oh, thanks.
Yes, let's talk about that. So so you have a PayPal thing where people can donate.
Yes.
On the mental illness. It's just a mental illness pod?
Mentalpod.com.
Mentalpod.com.
And they can either do a one-time PayPal donation or recurring monthly. And I love the recurring monthlies because it is a foundation that then I can go, okay, I can maybe extrapolate it to the point where I can go, well, maybe if the podcast keeps growing, I'll be able to support myself doing this.
Yeah.
And you can also buy... use our Amazon search portal, and then Amazon gives us a couple of nickels for when people buy stuff, and it doesn't cost them anything.
Right.
And I wanted to find a way to thank the monthly donors, and I thought about doing special episodes that only they could listen to, but one of the reasons I've shied away from doing that and having people pay for back episodes was I feel like all of this stuff should be free.
Right.
Because I started it to spread the message
right.
and to limit the message to people that have money or donate.
Seems counterintuitive.
It seems counter to it. But it does make me nervous sometimes that I'll never get to the point where I can make this my full-time gig. So one of the ways I thought I might...
Incentivize
or really just thank the monthly donors would be to make cutting boards and stuff like that and raffle them off that only monthly donors or people who have transcribed an episode could be eligible for. And it's been very, very gratifying to feel like I have a way to thank them other than with words.
And they are amazing pieces. Aww, they really are.
Thanks.
So, and what I think is spectacular about your site, too, is those forums are filled with people. That was some of the best forums I found about sort of medication and their, you know.
Have you posted anything in there or just browsed?
I'm not a poster. I'm a lurker. But
have you taken any of the surveys
no,
yet?
No. I'm not a survey taker really
no?
either. I fancy myself very busy. but I've enjoyed looking at them. And I think when you read the results on the podcast is great. Another thing that was super thrilling to me was having listened to the podcast so much and then going and interviewing Greg Barron and realizing that he was the one who says, "Well, you have a new intro now, I think."
But he's the outro at the end of it.
Oh.
He says, "You know, everybody I know
is so
bizarrely
beautifully
fucked up in some weird way."
I love it.
Yeah.
And then I always wonder who's the guy. I've never listened to the episode about the guy someone else's teeth, but I know that voice.
That's Murph. He was episode number 4. He's a friend of mine from my support groups, and he has a very, very interesting checkered past. Who is one of the greatest example of how people can change. I mean,
right.
He was a very violent, some would say, you know, asocial to the nth degree.
Well, with the quote that you used in the intro was, "I used to keep a cup of teeth in a jar," and you say, "Your teeth?"
And you said, "No, other people's teeth."
What the fuck are they talking about? Do I want to know? I don't know.
Yeah, you should listen to that episode.
Okay, number 4.
Yeah, number 4. And that was voted one of the top 10 of that year, of the first year, 2011.
How many episodes have there been so far?
131. I just put a little mini one out last night, which is just me reading an article, that article about co-narcissism.
And we didn't even talk at all about Dinner and a Movie. You were the host of it, the co-host for 8 years.
16.
16 years.
Yeah, but you got one of the numbers that divide into it.
I know. That was some, like, for me, that was a really impressive math skill right there.
That's nice.
And you co-host.
You could have said 32, which would have been much more flattering.
I know. Or 64. Look at me, Matt. Genius. What happens to me? And I know Annabelle Gurwitch does my live show.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
I have this live show
that has nothing to do with addiction or anything.
It's What's it called?
True Tales of Lust and Love. Many people you know have done it. Janet Varney has done it.
What nights is it on?
We've switched. We were at the Mint for a year and a half, the second Saturday of every month. And now we are at M-Bar, the third Thursday of every month.
What time?
It's at 8. And randomly, it's this coming Friday. Listeners, don't listen. This is, you'll have missed it. I'm so sorry. But that's a podcast as well.
You should be recording those. Absolutely.
Yeah, they're great. And I've done an all guys one that Paul F. Tompkins did. And it's been, it's something that, you know.
Do they read or just tell a story?
Half and half.
Okay.
And because I don't really, it's not that I don't care about it. It's because I didn't put that, like, must succeed with all my might and will and self-control. It's been very successful.
And those are the funniest things, the ones that you just don't have any attachment to.
I know. If only I could manage to have that same, you know, wearing my hopes for it like a loose garment.
Yes.
Because that works so well.
So well.
It's that, you know, and I do think that that's, you know, we should close out pretty soon. But, like, that's what alcoholism is about, is this, like, I will control and I will make this happen, and how ineffective that is.
And the fact that it works every once in a while, it's like the great golf shot that keeps you coming back, thinking, I'm going to break 80, or I'm going to, you know, break 100, whatever your thing is.
Or for me, the last couple of years, like those, that good night on cocaine, as opposed to the 700 other really shitty ones.
The worst hangovers ever. Cocaine hangovers.
Well, cocaine. The day after, I was great. The day after, wanted to kill myself every time.
Really?
Yeah.
You didn't drink as much as when you were, because I could only drink like a fish.
Yeah,
when
I could do some drinking, but
you wouldn't get hungover.
No, because what I would do, I would do coke first, and then I would use the what's it called, Amstel Light, and the vodka to come down, and then to come really down, I would just take like 5 Ambien, and I think maybe Ambien was like a hangover killer. I don't know. The hangovers weren't that bad.
How many times did you do coke?
Oh, that's not a countable number.
Really?
Oh yeah. No, I mean I have no idea how many years I was holed up in my apartment alone doing it.
Oh, I can't wait to have you as a guest.
Yes, I got tales. Now, okay, one thing I do is I take a listener question, and this one seemed so good for you. It is from @sax_0909, and he asks, how can a teenager who successfully completes treatment remain clean and sober after going home to functioning alcoholic parents? What's your take?
How old is he?
Who didn't say. And this is a hypothetical. He's not the teenager. He's just asking in general.
I would suggest two support groups.
Yep.
One for his addictions and one for codependency.
Well, and a support group for his parents.
Yeah, but he can't control whether or not they're going to go
to that
support group.
Right. But if the parents are alcoholic, I think that that is probably fairly common. The parents that say, okay, little Timmy's acting out and, you know, we have enough money to go, let's go send him off to wherever. And, you know, and in fact, there's addictive behavior going on in the home.
Mm-hmm. But what he has control over is how he handles that. You know what I mean? He can't control what they're going to do. He can only control his reaction to them, and I think and his desire to get loaded. And I think those two support groups that handle that would be the only thing he would have control over. It might make him even crazier to try to get them into support groups, to try to make them see that they're alcoholics. That can be one of the sickest things that
Yeah, or but I actually meant a support group for them in terms of dealing with an alcoholic, not with their own alcoholism.
Oh, so you're talking about the family dynamic, just not what he has control over. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And in that they would probably realize their alcoholism.
Hopefully.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood.
Well, and any parent who is thinking about sending a kid to rehab do know that it is a family disease, that it doesn't just incubate in some random kid who then goes and acts out. Oftentimes the child is reacting to what's going on. The whole family has to heal. If the kid is a teenager, I think for that teenager to have any success, the whole family has to work.
And get rid of the notion that the more money you spend on a rehab, the better their chances are of getting sober. I think the inverse is actually quite true, because the really expensive places often pamper and will enable that person's sense of entitlement, because they don't want to lose that huge amount of money that person is paying.
Well, I just respectfully disagree, just because.
Yeah.
I mean, I got sober at Promises, not the fancy one, mm-hmm. but the ghetto Promises, as we called it. So many of the high-end rehabs in LA have the greatest addiction experts in the world working for them. And I think that they get sort of tossed aside as, oh, well, you know, all those LA rehabs, they just cater to celebrities and it's all about the massages. And that's just simply not true. I mean, some of the smartest people I know work at those rehabs.
And that makes perfect sense to me. But the thing that I've heard from so many of my friends that have worked at these high-end ones is that the people that don't respect the rules don't get kicked out. So I think if somebody is willing to follow the rules,
right,
that's great. But I think, like, I'm a big fan of rehabs like Cry Help,
right,
which has a zero tolerance policy for people that flagrantly disobey the rules there. And I think it's that... I think alcoholics need consequences. And I know I'm not telling you anything that you don't know, but I think what made it the exception for you is it sounds like you were compliant when you went in there. You weren't going in there.
I was very, very desperate and willing. But they do. I mean, these rehabs do actually kick out people.
They do.
Yeah,
okay.
Because also, you don't get your money back. If you spend $50,000 on that rehab and you disobey the rules and you get kicked out on day 10, there's no refund coming. So it's not like they're incentivized to keep you there.
Because I think there are some.
There are probably some.
And those are the ones that I'm talking about.
But there are very few. I'm literally writing a story about this right now. There are two or three that we all, who kind of work around this world, know. You know, if you don't want to do the work and you need to get, like, a wife or, like, the press off your back, you go there.
Mm-hmm.
But 98% of them, that's just not true.
I have no idea.
Yeah. Look, change was just made. An epiphany was had, if you will.
Yeah, nice.
Or he's just being nice.
No, I'm not.
Yeah. Okay, well, this is great. This is fantastic.
I've really enjoyed this.
I've really enjoyed it, too. People can find... we've given the website out, but let's give out the information again.
It's called the Mental Illness Happy Hour, and the website is mentalpod.com, and you can also find it through iTunes. It's in, you can just search for it on iTunes and then make sure to click on the logo so the most recent episodes come up. And you can also find it by going to the health category and then the sub category of self-help.
And you're on Twitter, but you don't tweet a lot, let's be honest.
I tweet a fair amount. I don't tweet as myself. I tweet Mental Pod.
Oh.
Because I have at Gil Martini, which I don't think I've touched in 6 months.
Okay.
And but the one I tweet almost every day or every other day, and mostly it's related to the podcast, is at Mental Pod.
Okay.
So please follow me on that one, because that one means more to me than the other one.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Paul. It really was a pleasure.
Thanks, Anna.
Okay. I really enjoyed that.